Can I invite our other speakers up onto the stage for our Q&A? Can we put up the mobile number for texting your questions? And while people are coming up, Mark, how do you stop people gaming the Net Promoter Score? I mean, I've heard stories of, you know, can you just give, because people, you know, workers don't realize, they think an 8 is a good score, but you've really got to get 9 or 10. And they say, oh, look, it would be really good for us if you give us a 9, you know. How do you stop that gaming?
Oh, I think a part of that is obviously around the call listening and call coaching. So we obviously record all of the calls that come through. And, you know, if we had our, I suppose, the compliance type people, you know, listen to all those calls, as do the leaders, and we'd pick up whether there was sort of that sort of coaching going on to try and entice a high Net Promoter Score.
And so all that's terrific, but has it made the slightest bit of difference to return to work rates?
That's a good question for the actuaries. So, we've definitely seen, if I look at the New South Wales scheme, where I suppose Net Promoter Score has had, you know, significant focus in that scheme, I compare our Net Promoter Score, which is very positive at the moment, our return to work is improving quite significantly in that. So without going into the complete breakdown in detail and analysing it, anecdotally, return to work is improving in our scheme in New South Wales, as is Net Promoter. So you could draw that conclusion that they're both working together.
Well, to anybody on the panel, I mean, by the way, there's seats down at the front here rather than you standing up, so please come down and have a seat. Plenty of seats around. Oh, you're all into standing desks and things like that. Well, just asking the question of anybody on the panel, is there any evidence that going to a customer-centric focus makes any difference to some of the key metrics which matter to people, which is getting back to work? There's no faster way to poverty than being on benefits.
Look, there certainly is, and there's work. Mick Sullivan is one of the researchers that comes to mind who people might be familiar with. There's certainly work that would indicate that once people have a perception of injustice, it will reduce their health outcomes and return to work outcomes. I think Genevieve Grant, there are other researchers that have got quite a compelling body of evidence that the experience will trigger worse outcomes. And I think the opportunity out of that is to know that there's also a virtuous circle that you can build of having a better experience and giving people a greater chance that actually they're going to have better health outcomes.
So, Joe, what's the limit of that? You refer to the fact there's a limit to that because the customer's not always right. So, you know, the role of tough love, when do you put the barriers down? Because you can create that conflict that Carmel's seeking to avoid to enhance recovery.
I suppose not so much. I don't think of it so much in terms of limit or scope creep, but I think Carmel's absolutely right. It's go where the evidence takes you. So the evidence to me is absolutely overpowering, would be my response to your question about if people feel like the system has treated them fairly, if there's been authentic, clear, direct, honest communication throughout the process. That's about the best a system is going to be able to do. So in my mind, there's absolutely no doubt. And that would be intuitive. If you think about it, something really shocking happens to you. You get hit by a car. So you've had a really traumatic event in your life. But luckily we live in a country such as Australia where there are support systems that are around you. If you're then treated fairly, if you then feel like, well, the answers mightn't always be customers aren't always right, but there's no spin, you're honest, and you're not popping what we call that bubble of trust. And that's what we've learned over the years at the TAC, that we build up trust over many, many years. And if I sort of think in the no-fault space, one of the things we've learned in our common law space is just the very act of the TAC saying, right, now we're speaking about damages, we're going to refer you off to an independent medical examination, bang, trust popped, client saying, right, so you don't trust me anymore. Now, whether that's right or wrong, it doesn't really matter. There's a perception there of unfairness. So we have to be very judicious about how we think about our process. No, but in my mind, trust, authenticity, delivering what you say you're going to do, these are all things that contribute to better outcomes.
So, well, just talking about trust, one of the questions being SMSed in, so many of the changes being talked about do require trust between schemes and clients. How do you build that trust? And the person writing that question argues that it is low now. John Nagle?
Thanks, Norm. Yeah, look, we have a good example on the go at the moment with the changes we're making with GIO consolidating a lot of the older claims and EML employing new staff. One of the things we've asked for in that employment is they employ different style of staff. And, you know, we could probably give you dozens of experiences every day where those staff are just talking to people as human beings. And in fact, the common feedback in many cases, it's the first time they've been treated as a human being in some years. Now, you can't overcome a trust deficit, you know, with a couple of simple phone calls. It will take years of sustained effort. But the first thing to do is actually show people that there is a pathway, that there is actually a real desire to support them. And as we go down the track of automation, it's actually about working with them and their families and their employer to say that, that everyone is working to the same outcome. So trust will take time.
So how can you trust a system that's automated?
Sorry, what was it?
How can you trust a system that's automated?
Yeah, because most occasions it's not that complex. And most people actually understand and want to engage at their own pace. One of the biggest difficulties we're facing at the moment is low literacy. You know, we have 8 languages that a lot of our forms are designed in. And what we're finding, no matter how simple you make the form, people still don't understand it. So, you know, Mark mentioned a little video that we're trialling at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're going to do more of that. And, you know, what we're trying to make sure in an automated system is, in particular with AI platforms coming available, you can switch to their natural language very early on. And so you can actually start responding to the customer as an individual.
Claire, how do you approach this issue of trust? It's so clearly critical.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely critical. And I think that the biggest challenge is a bit, you know, for us in Victoria, one of the things around our prevention-led program is, to be perfectly honest, I'd say that we've lost a lot of trust in workers' compensation in Victoria. So what we know is that if you're injured, that your access to a lawyer is really early on in the claim. And so what that says to us is that if you want to know about...
I take it you're not rejoicing in that statistic.
No, we're not. Not because we don't think lawyers have a role, but they have that role's been created through them. And some people say it's, you know, great marketing and, you know, there's all these reasons. But to be perfectly honest, it's because I think we've left a vacuum for them to fill. And so really for us, we want to be the ones to actually help people through our system. We want to be able to provide that pathway and actually help them understand why you're going to an independent medical examination, what the different decision points are along the life of your claim, what other service can we offer you versus an actual claims management model that's actually much more about the process of managing somebody's injury to actually talking to them about recovery, rehabilitation, and what it really means to get their life back after an injury. And I think, and it's not that we don't have great examples of that, I mean, EML and Mark talked about that, and a lot of our agents are actually bringing that to the table, but we need to be doing a lot more of that. And so I would actually say that, and our service scores have been improving year on year, but there's also a point where they plateau. And how do you continue to get those gains where the service that you're offering is actually giving someone an outcome? It's not people like us. That's not what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve that you're well-informed, you understand the system, you understand the process, and that when you need a decision made, the decision is made in a timely way that you actually understand. And I think, you know, we've done a lot of work around reducing disputation, but we still have very high disputation. So there is something for us, I think, in Victoria around wanting to change that dramatically in terms of people seeing us as the trusted advisor in workers' compensation as well.
But there's a conflict of interest, isn't there?
There's a conflict of interest, I think, if you think about that our role is to get people off the scheme. I think that, and I do think...
Well, that's just a teeny-weeny little...
Yeah. Well, except I think that if you think about what, you know, we've been talking about today, and I think pretty much collectively across the panel is absolutely there is a role to manage the scheme. But ultimately we'll manage the scheme if we manage the people that the scheme is relying on in terms of their recovery. So if we are actually focused on somebody actually staying at work, getting back at work, getting back to life, actually getting the treatment and the support that they need to be able to do that, working with employers and workplaces around what they can do more, better and improve, because trust, to be honest with you, often starts with the employer's reaction to the injury. That's the first moment that they then will experience their interaction with us as well and how they enter into our scheme. So I think we've got to be, we're much more sophisticated. It's not just as simple of we need to get people off, we don't want to be paying benefits. There's an entitlement, and in fact people actually are owed that entitlement, but not in a way that is just about putting people through hoops to get access to it. It's actually being much more purposeful with an outcome at the end of it.
What are we going to do about the rehabilitation industry? Mark? Isn't this one of the biggest barriers in the way that they're really not up to the task?
Yeah,
or
sure.
Or there's huge conflict?
I think that the rehabilitation industry, I'm actually going to go and talk at the ARPA conference down in Canberra on Friday, and I think that they needed to look at what their business model is, because the days of...
Well, the business model is making money out of patients doing excess spinal surgery, which doesn't need to be done and probably going to turn people into cripples. I mean, and and sometimes even admitting to private hospital facilities where that probably gives you worse outcomes. I mean, top to bottom, side to side, this is a really problematic industry, is it not?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, and because, you know, as you were saying, we can actually do more damage to a person because we force them down a path that they didn't need to go down. And, to me, while workers' comp can be, and personal injury can be quite a complex environment, I think, I think it was Claire or John said that the one thing that we have to get right is identifying what's that actual barrier stopping someone going back to work. And I think where we often get it wrong is that we identify the wrong barrier, then we go down a whole path of treatment, which is the wrong treatment in the first place. So,
but that's often occurred before you even see them or know even there's a claim.
It could happen before you even see them. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
David Bowen?
I'm reflecting on a conversation I had recently with some allied health professionals in relation to autism. We were talking about early intervention, and I said, if it doesn't deliver outcomes, it's not early intervention. And they said, we might need to maintain the person for the rest of their life. Well, that's not an outcome. It seems to me you start with an outcome, and then the next step, and this is, I think, a challenge for all these schemes, start paying the rehabilitation providers, start paying your agents on achieving those outcomes. Mm.
So are any of you doing that? Carmel?
Well, I suppose I can answer from the perspective of a regulator, and I might invite people who are providers in the schemes that we regulate as well to pay on outcome. I don't think we've moved down that path substantially at all yet. Mm-hmm. I think it's yet to be tapped, and the step before that is having really good measurement of the outcomes first, so that you're actually, if you're going to fund on outcomes, that we're very, very clear about measuring them. And we've got quite a way to go with that still as well.
I was just saying, Norman, can I just add that? Yeah. I actually think the health industry doesn't understand how outcome measurement very well. Mm. So we're being asked to try to force an industry that at one level, we believe they're the experts in what that they do, and that the health industry has been arguing about outcome measurements for a very long time. Yet at the end of the day, we pay for treatment. Mm. And I think that, for workers' compensation and, CTP...
So you're part of the problem then. You're paying for treatment. That's crap.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that for us to actually start to have a conversation with the health sector and the bigger...
So tell me why you pay for spinal surgery. Can you just tell me why you pay for spinal surgery?
Well, we're challenging that in Victoria at the moment in terms of reducing that. I think the difference is that we're not health professionals and we trust the diagnosis and the treatment pathway that those very experienced and highly capable
and highly
qualified
conflicted
people... And that's the biggest challenge for us. And to be honest, I actually think in Victoria where we've seen a change in that dynamic is where health practitioners have come to us and said, you're actually doing the wrong thing by your client or patient, because we see some of our colleagues are doing the wrong thing by their patient. And that's the only time that we've really seen huge gains. And at the moment, spinal surgery is one of our priorities, but also say we've done some really interesting work with physiotherapy in Victoria around a different model around outcome as well. But it's fairly inconsistent in terms of the health sector and our ability to influence and change that, I'd say, beast, really, in this country. It's a fairly significant piece of work.
I'd like to come back and just signal something that I've been contemplating and speaking with people about. I agree with Claire. We are in a situation now where if you have a medical practitioner that says, I'm going to do spinal surgery on you, and another medical practitioner who would say, no, there's no evidence, don't, it leads to a dispute. So in New South Wales, our minister's announced he's going to review dispute resolution and have a strong consultation process around that for workers' compensation. One of the things that I would like to see is some real exploration about how the medical profession can help us more in this. And I've been talking with some people who are establishing a medico-legal college. And if you could have accredited medical practitioners who have like a specialty role in being the independent advisor that provides a medical report, and they're going to be committed to, in their accreditation, using the best evidence, then I think we could create a situation where treatment that isn't warranted will be successfully disputed and there'd be better guidance and consistency.
John Nagle?
Yeah, look, I think it almost goes back to the trust question. You know, if we came out and said Dr. Joe and Dr. Fred and Dr. Blue were the best doctors and you're going to get the best outcome, nobody would trust it. They'd be seen as company doctors, and so, you know, everyone run away from it. You can look at Whitecoat, you know, which is TripAdvisors for doctors. Lorica are working on a similar kind of platform where they're grading, you know, surgeons and outcomes. So in many respects, I think it's one we won't win. Again, community pressure has to win that one. Community has to become engaged and say, you know, if GP, you know, Dr. Howlong is in that area, you know, talk about him. If Surgeon X, you know, just likes cutting people open and the outcome's pretty rotten, talk about him. So how do we actually encourage that community input going forward? Because it keeps on coming back. We don't have all the
answers. Sounds to me you're all scared shitless of this.
Well, there's no answer. Because unless you actually have, you know, somebody like the AMA step in and truly regulate, we're not qualified.
Well, your peers.
Yeah. Mm. But if you're an injured worker and you've been off work for 3 years and someone's promising you the nirvana of a surgery that will make you better and everyone else is saying no, what are you going to do?
Kim?
We've established, it came through the 2013 amendments in South Australia, a motor accident injury assessment scheme. So they're accredited to conduct impairment assessments in the South Australian scheme. So we have a body that can be used for those independent assessments give that... And we've just reviewed 700 of their reports and run a session last week with the medical specialists that came in to get feedback on the quality of their reports. So we plan to keep leveraging off that engagement that they have with the scheme to have those roles and functions to oversee some of those decisions. I think the challenges we've got private sector underwriting in this is you've got four approved insurers that all might have different approaches to this. And so it's about, as a regulator, it's about establishing frameworks for decision making about how do you go about deciding you're going to make this decision and having those really well articulated out and build those with the industry. We've engaged with all of the stakeholders as the allied health professions and the AMA and the GP groups to do that. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, like we look at the data and you can see one insurer has funded three different modalities at the same time. You know, chiro, massage, and physio.
Let's move earlier. Sorry, David, did you want to say something?
Look, I think the start to person-centred, person-directed, consumer-directed is empowering consumers by giving them information.
Yeah.
And there's two ways to do that. One is by becoming a source of information on clinical studies, and I'd refer you to a wonderful website out of the US called Patients Like Me, which was set up back by a brother, a person with a significant disability, who thought the information from clinical studies was so limited, he wanted to check with the broader community of people, and it's now built up to a massive database. But then secondly, start the collection of outcome information and feed it back in, and your own schemes become the most powerful source of information to correlate good outcomes with different services and treatments.
And you feed it back to clinicians as well, so they know what their own performance is relative to their colleagues. Let's move back up the scale and talk about return to work and improving return to work statistics. And that critical 21-day window. Joe, how are we going to get better at that?
We have to learn from each other, which I know is an obvious answer, but if I sort of think of, we've got our head of independence in the room today, Liz Cairns, who brought some wonderful experience across from the NDIS. And one of the great things that Liz brought into the TAC is we traditionally thought of return to work in what I'd call, you know, the 80%, the 90% space. So even our mindset for our most catastrophically injured clients was return to work is over there, but here's a wraparound lifetime care model for those that are catastrophically injured. And I think under Liz's leadership, we had a 21% improvement in return to work in a year, starting with us, actually with a pretty paternalistic mindset of actually it's wraparound care for you. So a bit of ambition and a bit of challenge for our own business models. There's no single silver bullet that we have. Another thing is actually just the blunt increase in investment. So some of the work I think that's been done in South Australia about case management out there face-to-face. So it's always a delicate balancing act running these schemes that you're trying to be efficient and effective. So we've just put some more hard bodies and hard resources out there about visiting some of our clients to assist. So unlike workers' comp schemes, not all of our clients are employed at point of accident. So we're having the conversation here about the TAC. It's not so much about the value of return to work. It's actually about the value of work. So if you're a 19-year-old dirt bike rider that's had a really shocking accident, got all this evidence that says work's going to be a really important factor in your recovery, you're not at work at the moment. It challenges our role and our thinking.
So you really need client-reported outcomes.
Yeah, indeed. But actually, you know, you start with a bit of aggression and a bit of ambition. So for me, it's very easy to get doom and gloom about return to work. But just personally, our scheme is nowhere near maximising where we can get to our performance in return to work, principally by building off. There's a lot of really good practical evidence of how these schemes are doing it.
Mark?
I'd agree with what Joe's saying as well, but I suppose I look at it from a workers' comp perspective. You know, again, from my personal experience from the many injuries I've had, at the end of the day, you need to get the right diagnosis, get the right treatment as early on as you can, and you need a really supportive workplace to help you get back. And I think if we can...
But you need a system that intervenes in the first 3 weeks.
What's that, sorry?
You need a system that intervenes in the first 3 weeks. You can have all the net promoter scores you like.
Yeah, and I suppose that's been the value of the mobile piloting that's been done in Victoria and in South Australia, where it's legislated to do the mobile case management. And we are finding, getting out there to the workplace, you can actually identify when there's industrial issues out in the workplace. And with the right people in those roles, you can mitigate all that from one visit out to the workplace.
So tell me what makes a good case manager in your book.
That's a really good question, and I think that, as John said, the nature of case management is changing because as systems are getting more intuitive and they're taking away a lot of the process-based sort of manual tasks that case managers had to do in the past. So I think that we definitely want people who have good empathy from a customer experience point of view, but then as the claim is probably getting older or less likely to get an outcome, then you're going to need some of that specialist expertise to come in over top to help that. So I think, you know, the model where you need really good customer service people sitting in those roles is important, but I suppose as the claim ages, then you need to get the assistance of specialised people to come in and assist with that. So it is changing. There's no doubt about that. The old days back in the old days, you generally would get a case manager who's really good at processing but not good at thinking outside the square for injury management. And you couldn't get both of them because someone either hated doing processing and they liked the injury management or vice versa. Where now, because the systems are getting more intuitive and intelligent, you're getting rid of the processing stuff and now you can actually put genuine people in that care about the worker and want to build that trust and get the outcome.
Carmel?
I'm thinking about a couple of publications and this goes back to the return to work question as well. That Safe Work Australia have put out on the 1st of November. And they built on the analysis from the survey, so that it's a random sample survey where self-reporting of have I returned to work, but there's also a mine of data about what was the individual's experience throughout the life of their workers' compensation claim. And they've reported, there's two other reports, for Dr. Mary Wyatt is the lead author, that have come out on the 1st of November, that are really drawing a connection between, have you had access to a GP, was that helpful? Did your employer make contact within the first few days? And, you know, it needs to be high quality contact. The claim handling experience, and linking those to that the outcome measure of did you report return to work. And there are some real insights there that so in CIRA we've been working with Mary Wyatt and thinking about how would we oversample, how would we measure more regularly whether some of those experiences about the claimant experience, about the employer reaching out, about the access to GP that are driving the outcome are happening through the management of claims, and then turn that into our measurement of insurers in our insurer supervision model to say, you know, to what proportion are we reporting, being able to track down to different types of insurers that you're driving those behaviours that drive the outcome.
So, John Nagle, what about evidence-based interventions? It's fine saying we're going to get you in the first while, there's good quality reporting from the employer, but what the heck do you do in that first 3 weeks apart from good quality communication and case management? Is there are there evidence-based interventions that work?
Yeah. So part of our new model is, as I mentioned, built off the ODG, the Official Disability Guidelines. And that is, it's not evidence-based medicine, it's built into it, but it's actually about the best practice across the globe. So let's say it may not be, if you've got a broken right arm, do you need 4 physiotherapy sessions? Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. But if it's work somewhere, give it a try. And so I think it's about, again, capturing somebody early in the piece and trying to show the support for them. We're looking at pre-approval of simple treatments. So straight away, someone can say, instead of having to fight and ask for everything, just look after yourself. Yeah, I think Joe mentioned that, you know, the best outcomes on a global basis. People looking after themselves want to get back to work. People who have to go through a process fight the process. So if we can get them back on track, just make it easy for them to concentrate on their own recovery, we believe that's what people will do.
So one of the questions here from on the texting was, well, what outcome, and you referred to it a little bit, Joe, is what outcomes beyond return to work should we be looking at here? Kim?
Well, that's the challenge, I think. What are those other outcomes? As I said earlier...
Well, do you agree with the contention that really you shouldn't decide that's a client-reported outcome? Or do you think there are outcomes which materially affect your business?
I think there are. I think return to work is an extremely important measure because of its financial impact on the scheme if somebody doesn't return to work, and that's just the facts. At the end of the day, the motor vehicle owner must pay the premium. But what I think is more interesting is that question around impact on the system of claims, of compensation, has on the individual. So are people coming out the other end in worse shape than they went in, or with consequential problems that they didn't have to start with, whether it be the spinal surgery or whether it be secondary mental health issues. But we've got to understand...
I mean, let me just interrupt. It strikes me that the industry, and I would include not just the insurers, regulators, but also the providers, have two... Their expectations are too low.
Yep.
And you're too kind of reserved and namby-pamby about all this.
Really?
I'd tell them that. I mean, like I said, just from a Victorian experience, so... remember that, you know, 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago, you're talking about bankruptcies and market failure. So here you're speaking about, so the remarkable consistency about, you know, customer at the centre, health outcomes when you're speaking about multi-billion dollar insurance schemes. So I'd reject the namby-pamby assertion. I think the great strategic challenge here is, while there's decades of academic literature and discussion about health outcomes client at the centre, you've got schemes here that are operationalising that very easy one-liner to say. So whether it is, I mean, return to work's an obvious one, family participation. So some of our clients in our Ripple houses. Mm-hmm. So that's led to family connections, you know, a father reconnecting with his sons that hasn't been able to happen. Now, this is just not warm and fuzzy type of thing. That has demonstrable, quantifiable evidence on people's health returns. So, well, it might come across as a bit KPIs and a bit insurance-driven. I'd reject the that we're setting the sights low.
David Bourne?
Yeah, I...
You've lost a lot of friends already. You may as well just go for it. And you haven't heard the next question.
Back when I was at the Motor Accidents Authority and Carl was involved in this, we did a piece of work called the Trauma Collaboration, and we tracked a whole range of people from the point at which they were retrieved from a motor accident through that retrieval, through accident and emergency, surgical, intensive care, surgical care, rehab, post-rehab, back in the community. And the discrepancy between how all of the professionals measured outcomes, which certainly in the acute care phase and rehab, was the person's condition at handover, compared to how the patient felt about it and the claimant felt about it, was how's this going to impact on how I'm able to get back to my life, participate in the community, get back into my family. So I think the outcomes start with what people value. The NDIS has built an outcome framework in multi dimensions, and it's all collected annually from the participants' feedback to it. But it's broadly against three measures. One is a measure of independence and control a person has over their own life, and the others are around opportunity for economic participation, opportunity for meaningful community participation, because that's what was valuable to our participants.
Mark, do you think
Norman. I just thought I'd add a comment. You know, I think when you look across the schemes, you know, the great bulk of people go through the schemes, go through it without any problem. So the percentage of people who have real difficulty, you know, is relatively small, but it grows every year. But I think the question is around, do people truly understand the impact of a, you know, workplace injury when it doesn't go well? And, you know, we have people ringing us to say, please don't speak to my husband, because when you give him bad news, he beats me up. You know, we have children who witness, you know, parents trying to commit suicide because they can't take the pain anymore. And then you wonder why they're not succeeding at school. Mm-hmm. Now, we can only pay money. You know, we can only support people. There's a much bigger issue here. And I think saying the schemes are namby-pamby when they're trying to address societal issues that are incredibly deep is quite unfair.
Mark, do you think actuaries are providing you with the information you need for to actually predict recovery?
It's a loaded question, isn't it? We're sitting today.
worst that can happen to us is we're never invited back.
I think absolutely they do. I think that I think there's more that can be done in that space. And I think, as you know, you've heard a lot of us talk about today around the importance that we're placing on the customer experience. Like, how do you start tying that in with the actual return to work numbers and liability valuations, I suppose. So, you know, we can demonstrate that providing a better experience up front is going to lead to a better return to work outcome. So I think definitely there's some stuff that we can do more in that space. But, you know, certainly the actuaries that I work with at EML, I feel really positive that they give us good insight around how our portfolio is going and where the opportunities are to improve in that, to improve in from a claims management point of view in terms of getting return to work outcomes and liability reduction.
Do you agree with that, Claire? Are you getting the information you need to predict?
Me, did you say?
Yep, recovery?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think there's something for me around the role the actuaries can play around design. So as we're trying to, and, you know, we've heard lots of change today around we need to be, you know, earlier intervention, a quicker response, the social impact of injuries and personal injuries. So how do you model that in terms of how the actuaries currently think about how they predict the cost of certain decisions? So I think there's something for me, and I don't know the answer. I think it's a really, probably it's a good conversation to keep having. I think in our organisation, the actuaries are absolutely working, you know, probably leading some of the thinking that we're doing in terms of Strategy 2030. So to actually have actuaries at that table are really important around understanding those changes that we're making and the implications that we'll have. So I would say yes, but I'd be really keen to hear actually from the actuaries around whether they think we've got them engaged at the right time and in the right conversation around what we're trying to achieve in terms of a future way of claims management.
Norman, if I could make a comment. I think there's a limitation on how much information you can get just continually interrogating your own databases, no matter how sophisticated they are. And it's starting to look at other information that impacts people's lives at the broadest level, socioeconomic information out of ABS, correlate that, because that we know that has a bearing on people's health generally, at a population level. So, of course, it's going to impact on how they go through a process of recovery from injury, cross-referencing to involvement in other human service systems, because we often know, certainly in my scheme, I'm sure it's true of others, the people at high risk of injury in motor vehicle are often caught up in many, many other systems. And that way you start to get the opportunity yeah. only, but the opportunity for some coordination between those different service systems.
Yeah. Almost all of you talked about getting out of the way. I'm not sure I know what you mean, and what's the limit to getting out of the way? Joe?
So what's a good example of that? So what's a practical example of we have applied a medical excess for 30 years at the PAC, and there's reasons why that was introduced in 1986, and it's half its way through the Victorian Parliament right now, where we made the case, actually, let's just get rid of it. You know what I mean? So if all the evidence is early intervention, get in there quick. So what we did at the TAC is we got really, really good at accepting claims quickly. So it went from 2 months to 2 days. And then we got really good at saying to most people, now can you nick off and rack off $651 and come back? So that's an example there where now with the PwC, Lisa Simpson, our chief actuary, it's not broken. We don't have people screaming. It's not front page news. But we said if we hand on heart believe that's something that's in the way of a long-term health outcome, why are we stuffing around so many thousands of people? So with PwC, that'll cost us money. That might cost us $5 to $10 million a year, but we have to go to the state treasury, to the board, to the ministers and say, actually, just because that's been a policy measure that's existed for 30 years, we believe it's not part of our future. Bipartisan support, it's going to be abolished by Christmas. So that's just one example. The other example is that you've seen on the back of our data and analytics, 80% of our clients are with us for about 3 months. So 4,000 of those just want an ambulance bill paid. And what we very much used to do was push it all onto the punter. You get the form, you fill it out right, you go to the police, you go there. If you tick the box wrong, we'll reject it and the like, versus saying that's systemically.
But I read getting out of the way is, you know, just let it take its own course, it's going to be all right.
No, not so much. So from a TSE perspective, I'd say for the vast majority of our clients, what you want is the system supporting the individual. So if I take that example of someone that's had a minor injury, really what you want is you want that person focused on their recovery. So we're here at a hospital, we might have an overnight stay, the person's checking out the next day, what do I need to do? Nothing. Your claim's been accepted. The ambulance bill's going to be paid. What we want you to do is focus on your recovery. So it's not for everybody, but getting out of the way where you're adding no value gives you the opportunity to invest all of your resources and time, because where we'd all be undercooked would be in clients of complexity. So it just gives us a shot to better allocate our resources.
Carmel?
Everything he said, plus I'm thinking at it from the perspective of a regulator. We have done a lot of reviewing the regulatory methods that we inherited upon CIRA being set up, and there are lots of little examples of where we've said, why are we doing that? Why would a self-insurer need to come to us to get approval because they change someone in their claim handling team? Like, so a lot of...
So getting out of the way is cutting red tape.
Cutting red tape and really saying, OK, we're not going to be prescriptive about things where we can't see there being a very high risk. There may be some times where we would. And be very clear that we hold you accountable for the outcome. We're going to measure that. You don't have to keep coming back to us with silly little questions that are really up to you to manage.
So I focused a little bit, and we've got a session tomorrow morning on mental health, but I want to talk about that now. Mm. Because, you know, low back pain. You think we could have sorted out low back pain, and we haven't. Mm. It's a disaster area. What tooling up do we need for early identification and rehabilitation paths in mental health problems in the workplace that could have been caused by work? Claire.
Yeah, I was just, when you were talking, Norman, I'm thinking that the focus for us at the moment is how do you actually prevent people becoming mentally unwell? And I think that's been the big challenge. And when we talk to employers, one of the things I think we've got very good at is we understand, a tripping hazard, or we understand guard on machinery, or we understand manual handling, even though, you know, we still have a long way to go with those injuries as well, unfortunately. We've made great gains on people just understanding how you actually can prevent that and do more about it.
But we've got a century of management science. We actually know what causes mental health injuries in the workplace through poor management, poor structure and so on. We probably don't need very much more research.
What stops us from implementing them? And there's a few things I would say. So in my time in this industry, we tried to have this conversation about 8 years ago, and I can assure you, employers, nobody wanted us to have that conversation. There was a real nervousness around this is going to open up Pandora's box, there's going to be a flood of claims for people with mental injury. Employers are thinking, I don't quite understand, you know, I know my obligations, but, you know, people come in with their own pre-existing issues and conditions, and how am I now going to have to manage that? Because then people are going to have to tell me about their whole life. And whereas today, it's a totally different conversation. Employers are wanting to have a very open and transparent conversation about what do I need to do? How can I change the culture in my workplace? How can I have a conversation around workload? How can we talk about poor management versus management that's actually supportive and encouraging? And so it has moved, regardless of how long we've known. I always think that sometimes, you know, we create the evidence, but it might take another 10 years for the change to occur. There's something lined up right now that all of us are prepared to have that conversation. And I think not just because of the implications in terms of cost on schemes like ours, but again, going back to our social responsibility to people in the workplace, the economic burden we know that mental health has and what it does have on business as well. And I also think in terms of that most of us actually want to have a different experience through work. And I think so finally we're starting to have a different conversation. So it's leveraging that, knowing when someone's becoming unwell, intervening early. And I think, you know, from Kim's perspective around are you okay, really simple but incredibly effective. And it also means that for all of us, we don't have to know about mental health, we just have to care. So, and it's cultural change, I think, in workplaces. And I think we're starting to see that happen.
So I'm taking from this a very important message is, and it's probably part of the rehabilitation, is that the workplace has got to change, because if you want to get into return to work, it's got to be a very different environment from the one that allegedly caused the injury in the first place. But John, I want to come to the interventions. So controversial though the interventions might be in physical rehabilitation, they're extremely controversial in there. Try and find an evidence-based psychologist who'll do, you know, high-fidelity cognitive behavioural therapy or interpersonal psych, you know, really hard stuff. Mm. What extent have you got confidence that the rehabilitation industry is able to rehabilitate when you've got a mental health, a psychological injury or an alleged one?
Not very confident.
You have a responsibility to improve that base rather than just sit there and wait for the medical and psychiatric, psychological system to get better?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the things we're observing is there has to be a workplace change where, you know, with respect to anybody from the HR or people engagement space out there in the audience, their first responsibility when somebody comes along and says, I've got a problem, is defend the company. You know, put up the barriers, close it down, control it, instead of embracing the individual. You know, people come to work as a whole person. So if the dog died or the kid's having problems at school or, you know, a friend or a family member's got cancer, they're bringing that to work. And until workplaces actually start coming back to kind of being a community, it's difficult. And if you think about the gig economy as well, where you're going to have lots of people coming in and out of your business who may be there for a little while and go away and come back, etc., it's going to get more complicated. So the treatment path, you know, really understands about how do we get close to the individual very early on. And I think, yeah, there are tools and techniques, but I don't think anyone really has the answer yet about what is the treatment pathway that you would roll out. But it starts with engagement. It starts with saying, there's an individual, how do we help? And then working your way through various pathways.
So what are we going to do about the gig economy? What do we predict is going to happen? Mark, have you given this thought?
Yeah.
Or is it not relevant to what you do?
No, absolutely it's relevant, because obviously, you know, there's you know, more preferences around probably more interaction through digital channels than you know, what's been rather than paperwork. So I think that, you know, we have to be well aware around the changing workforce and the changing characteristics of the workers coming in. And we, you know, as John mentioned, we need to make sure that we provide choice to these people around how they interact with us and interact within the scheme.
I'm actually fascinated by it, and I was hoping that some of the people out here in the audience have the answer. Yeah, I can't look ahead 10 years.
Not a single question on the gig economy.
The reality is, as you see more and more people moving either into self-employment through the gig economy, you know, when you're looking at a large-scale funded scheme, what does that do to our premium pool? What does that do to us going forward? And if you say, you know, that you've got someone who's working three different roles and comes up with a mental health claim or a low back, who's paying for it? All three employers? You know, how do we apportion it? I'm quite sure that somebody else in this up here has got the answer for me. But I don't know. But we're going to have to address it pretty quickly.
Kim?
Oh, look, I think it's even the workforce itself, you know. We've got a changing attitude to work, working flexibly, working from home, working from anywhere, and how you, as older managers, just respond to that to make sure that everyone's productive and getting through the work that they need to do, but still keeping that connection and that engagement. From a scheme perspective, it's about the multi-channel. You've got to know who you're providing the service to, who are your customers, and having a multi-channel.
Do we need a fundamental redesign for that part of the economy? Carmel?
I think we have to think about it. And as John's aware, we're hosting a round table on the gig economy that John and I'll both be at. It's, you know, it's a small start, where my approach in is to explore this as the big complex issue that it could be. I know that there are people who I speak to who say, well, you're going to need to have some legislative reform to tighten up this provision here and tighten up that one. But I think we have to be braver in thinking, what's the intent for workers' comp or CTP? Why did they start in a world where there was a huge health burden driven by a particular type of activity that you could do, like using the road or being at work, that seemed to make sense as a discrete activity in the 1940s? What will it mean when we have more flexibility and agility and work is more flexible and could, you know, we already know it could be within a motor vehicle and there's overlap there. So I think we have to go back to what's the intent, what are the social objectives, and in a world where, and you know, this is blue sky thinking and I don't know how far away it is, but in a world where we get better and better at safety, will it make sense to have silos, which is one of the reasons why I think the model that we've embarked on in New South Wales to join up the regulation of these injury schemes may have some superior potential, because we're starting to say, where's the overlap? You know, what if the intent is to see that people who have an injury. Now, it might be based on some idea of tort law still, where there's someone else at fault who should be on risk and some indemnity needed, etc. Is that going to work? But I think we need to start thinking about horizons ahead. There may be a complete reinvention of that needed for our children and our children's children.
But it's a national horizon,
yes.
And we're still dealing with separate schemes.
Mm.
Why? What on earth is the reason that we've got different schemes, is another one of the questions here, around the country? We've got a national disability insurance scheme. We've got fairly uniform changes in terms of the way people live and work. And we've got separate schemes. It's rubbish, isn't it, David?
I agree. And
you're the only person I can ask where it's not career ending.
No. And I mean, if you want to go back in history, in 1974 there was legislation in the Commonwealth Parliament that would have subsumed all of these schemes, and the early one around a health scheme all into a national system, and it fell over when the dismissal occurred. So putting the NDIS in conjunction with the NIIS back on the agenda really is, you know, a generation later. Going back to...
So is that going to force more uniform activity? Because presumably if you're... I mean, I think a lot of people in the room, well, maybe they know, but I don't. I don't understand how NDIS intersects with all this conversation here.
And that might take me more time to explain immediately than we have.
Well, we
don't
really know yet, do we?
The segmentation of injury from other disability was really a recognition of the existing statutory compensation schemes and a recognition that there was a different potential funding source for other injury sorts. Still not sorted out what that funding source is. So the national agreement of all governments is both to an NDIS, which is now being implemented, and an NIIS to be progressively implemented. We're in the transition stage of that, where all states and territories have to, at a minimum, provide no-fault workers' compensation and motor vehicle injury support. And if they don't, the NDIS provides the support and then just recoups it from the state treasuries. From 2020, that will be the position for all other injury types. So while I was somewhat critical earlier of the Commonwealth Treasury for not progressing this as a policy leaders on it, the actual cost of the NIIS is going to be met by the states and territories anyway. And so it's really, and the experts on that in the states and territories are the existing compensation schemes. So that's where the impetus to move this policy work along, I think, really rests.
Sure.
And just, I think here's one where I think the market pressure on our schemes alone drives a bit of the harmonisation. So I would be completely pessimistic at a political, regulatory level that we'll get many gains, but just a nice little practical example, it would be completely pointless for the TAC to march out there with providers and say, right, we've got a new health outcome framework that we're going to compensate you on. If it is vastly different to what WorkSafe are doing, if it is vastly different to what the NDIS is doing, because what we would be is a total minnow out there in a market saying for TAC clients, this is really bespoke and important for us. And the big strategic issue we would face is the market saying, actually, we've got plenty of work servicing the NDIS. We don't need you. We don't need for you to support your clients. So regardless of any absence of top-down Canberra push, we as a business need to be easy to deal with, consistent and as harmonised as is humanly possible. So that's where I kind of think, in one respect, a little bit of market pressure on our businesses is where I think you'll see the harmonisation, as opposed to 78 brown cardigan committings out of Canberra, which will be talk-fest.
Yeah, I think the fact that as each of the speakers got up today and talked, there were resonant themes and things that we're all finding as challenges and opportunities means that potential for operational convergence, where we actually start saying, well, instead of reinvent the wheel, what are others doing? Start to learn more and then create a more... the sort of experience that means that if I'm over the border, I can expect the same as I can in New South Wales, and it's both being evidenced, informed and continuing to improve. We can do a lot without the kind of political level or legislative change.
What would be the highest priority in this area from your point of view, Kim?
I was having a chat with one of my colleagues from Western Australia. I think it was 15 years ago we tried to get a common definition of road and we weren't able to achieve that. between the states and territories and the Fed. So, and then we tried to get a common injury coding tool so we could all compare experiences in our schemes. We didn't achieve that either.
But WA is incredibly self-satisfied. I mean, I was doing a session there not so long ago, and they think they've got a terrific scheme with fantastic return to work rates. When you look at them, they're not fantastic, and they haven't been able. And they've one of the first places to have an NDIS type system, and it's not integrated. I mean, it doesn't seem to be well integrated across the state. And if they can't do it, what hope the rest of us got?
Mm. I think while it's also the other challenge is we are at the will of the government of the day. Each state and territory has a government that's been elected by its people. But
Joe's point is that the market will put the pressure on governments, whether it's state or federal. Do you agree with that?
Not particularly, because I think the market will only put pressure on the government if they're informed. And, you know, from my perspective as CTP in the CTP world, people don't know what CTP is or interested in it until they actually can't afford their premium, or they're actually having to engage with the system. So it's not a big conversation piece over a barbecue. So understanding what benefit structures are available in the TAC or in another jurisdiction compared to what South Australia's got, people don't know that, and they're not engaged in that conversation.
John Niggle? I mean, it strikes me that this is becoming, you know, this is coming at you like a locomotive, amongst other things.
Yeah, I think I can rely on GST and Medicare. You know, when you know, you can't even agree a share on GST, how would you agree to share workers' compensation, premiums and costs and all the rest of it? So not in my lifetime.
I think I was going to say, I think there's opportunities, but for us to be more collegiate in some areas. Like I think one of the big things that we should all be doing better at is helping educate GPs around the importance of work and the impact that has of someone recovering to where they were. And, you know, I think there's nothing stopping us as an industry doing more work in that regard to better educate them.
And the other thing, I think, just generally coming, that the big disruptor is indeed autonomous vehicles and what's coming through from 2020 onwards, and having that mix of road use, et cetera, will require all its schemes to be opening up that piece of legislation and restructuring it and rewriting it.
Do you think that's really going to happen? You do?
Yeah.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, TSE perspective, and there's actually a plug for Jeff Atkins of Finity has published a wonderful paper, I think, in terms of the intersection from the road safety perspective in the CTP schemes. The one that will call out, so over the long, medium to long run, wonderful optimism about autonomous vehicles and technology. The founding father of Vision Zero in Sweden, Klaus Tingvall, was in Australia recently, and his call out to the TAC was, don't have your next road safety strategy as 58 pictures of driverless cars. So over the medium, long term, wonderful injury prevention. However, today, there's a kid in Mildura that's just gone and bought a ute that we've let into the country that's one star, no side curtain airbags, is going to drive on a road without a barrier, and is going to be an acquired brain injury client. So I'm the biggest believer in autonomous vehicles and technology, with this big caution on, it's not...
There's a job of work to be done beforehand.
There's time to unfold.
Yeah, it takes 20 years to turn the fleet over in South Australia. So this mix of vehicles that will be on the road with different stages will go on for many, 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 many years, which will be the challenge for how you decide if you look forward looking on what your scheme structure is.
Lots more to talk about, but that's why you're here at the conference and going to all the concurrent sessions. Could you please join me in thanking the...